Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So last night, Lumpur mentioned, say Armand had this idea of taking a bow drill to the Yosemite trip to start fires with, and this is my response to Armand. Those of you with your eyes closed or listening to a talk, I have a Bic lighter, and just with one simple thing with the look with the thumb, there's a fire. So where I'm going with this is last year, right before New Year's, I was living up at the White Salmon, the Pacific Hermitage, and I was kind of trying to come up with a theme for a talk, and right before New Year's, and we got a brochure in the mail from the community college listing all the classes that they had to offer, and I was just sort of perusing through it just before we used it for fire starter, and there are a couple of classes in there I was kind of wishing I could take, like introduction to welding classes and stuff like that, but there were a lot of actually kind of interesting things that they would offer, just classes. And so I kind of had the idea, I talked about this a couple times here, quite a few times, about using artwork as a way of kind of learning about your mind and using it as an aid to meditation practice. And so I kind of gave a talk about, as a New Year's resolution to, kind of expand your knowledge, or, to not necessarily take a class at this community college, but just take on an adhitana, a determination to learn a new skill, to learn something in the year. And then I kind of talked about it in terms of how to use that as meditation, no matter what the thing was that you were trying to learn. Like here in the monastery, if you're learning to take on a new task, like doing the Anumodana cards, or learning how to fill propane tanks, or learning how to be a kitchen manager, how do you take these duties and skills and use them, as a way to aid you in your meditation. And so, since I kind of talked about that, I decided I would take on something, try to learn about something. And so, interestingly, the thing that I decided to learn about was, partly because my 50th birthday was coming up, and I've always had this fantasy about starting fires, and without using matches or a Bic lighter. And here I was 49 years old, and I'd actually never done anything about it. I'd never taken any classes. I'd never, joined the Boy Scouts or anything like that. So I'd never done it. So I just started doing a little bit of kind of research on it. And it's interesting, human beings have found, hundreds of ways to start fires. And I was thinking about the bow drill that Armand was, talking about, and that's a very, very traditional way of doing it. But if you understand how to do it, I've actually never made one, so I'm actually looking forward to the Yosemite trip to try it. But it's not necessarily complicated, but it takes a lot of pieces of equipment. It takes a board that you have on the ground that's got a notch cut into it to kind of create an ember by the friction. Then you have a long, thin pole that, when it's turning back and forth, creates the tension. But then you also need a rope or a piece of string, and then a bow that you create. So there's four pieces of equipment right there. But then you also have to have special sort of piles of dried kindling and tinder and firewood. So it's, you have to actually do quite a bit of work, preparation work, even before you, start even making using the equipment. So it's at least you have seven different pieces of equipment there, just to before you even start making the effort to create the heat and get the ember going. And so, you know, obviously, you know, like things like, you know, that's very time consuming. And so human beings have, you know, perfected it. And the method I like using is flint and steel. And so it's basically like four pieces of equipment instead of the seven that I was mentioning before. And then I won't get into the process of how you do that. But then, you know, that's doing some reading about it. And, you know, people who do that all the time, like, you know, say if you're just lighting a cigar or trying to light a candle, you can perfect that skill so it actually doesn't take that much more effort than sort of, say, striking a match. And so you can get it down. But it is a little more complicated, and you do have to have a little bit more equipment to start that fire. So people came up with the, you know, invention of matches. But, of course, I think probably everyone here has, you know, had matches or played with matches or depended on them for something. And, you know, they get wet, they don't work. If the striker gets worn on them, they don't work. You know, so there's lots of, you know, frustrations that can happen with, you know, something as ingenious and simple as a matches. And so, you know, Bic lighters or disposable lighters were kind of, you know, the next, you know, easiest thing to do. And so that is the easiest, probably, in terms of, you know, things that I've read about and have seen. And but, you know, even a Bic lighter, though, is quite complicated if you actually understand the lighter itself. And it's actually based on the same as flint and steel. If you has a little, where the thumb goes down, it's moving a wheel that has a piece of steel on it that strikes against something harder than the steel and creates a spark. And then has a butane fuel underneath of it that also, when you press the button, allows a little bit of fuel out and then it ignites. So, you know, any of those things go wrong, say if you're going backpacking or camping or, you know, in an emergency situation in your house and the lighters cracked and all the fluids dissolved or evaporated, then that's not going to work. Or if the, even sometimes if they're wet, they don't work. And so it's, you know, not a sure thing, even the, say, the Bic lighter. And so with that, with all of this, is what I'm kind of getting to, is that, you know, I think with the Bic lighter and just sort of, you know, kind of making a joke of this is my response to Armand and just, you know, lighting the lighter, it's like, I think we often have that view about many things in life. It's like, well, we just want to do the simplest, the easiest, the most direct way. And most of the time, that's not a problem. It's even intelligent to try to be efficient, to not waste resources. And if it's, you know, something that you need to be getting on to doing something else, if it's a means to an end, then that's actually fine. But in terms of like meditation, you know, it's like, you know, why did we, you know, why are we practicing? Why are we, you know, meditating? And so, you know, for almost all of us, it's you know, we've seen dukkha, we've seen that there is difficulty in life, and that we're seeking, you know, answers to that, trying to figure out, you know, why that's happening. You know, how is there a way out of that? And for many of us, we've had the experience of, you know, a deep meditation where, you know, for periods of time where that dukkha completely absolved, or we just even maybe have the confidence or, you know, faith that you know, meditation is going to lead us out of suffering. And so we can think of, you know, we can have that kind of view of well, the way out of dukkha is through meditation. And to me, that'd be like the Bic lighter. You know, it's like, okay, I just want give me one technique and I'll just use meditation. And I guess Ajahn Chah was even sort of criticized by the villagers. I've heard stories about this where when Westerners would come to him and he would teach them meditation. And the villagers would be like, well, you know, shouldn't you be teaching them sila, or shouldn't you be teaching them service, or shouldn't you, you know, just all these other aspects of Buddhism that, you know, that you grow up with in a Buddhist culture. And I heard Ajahn Chah's response was, well, Westerners like candy, so I'm going to give them candy. And then, you know, if they keep coming back, then we can sort of introduce the sila, and we can introduce the practice, the other practices. And so, also last night in Lumpur's Dhamma talk, he mentioned that, you know, devotion isn't one of the practices that most Westerners have much experience with or even understanding. You know, it's very common to, you know, just to, when I first started reading Dhamma books, a lot of the very first ones were, say, Ajahn Lee Dhammadharo. And in almost all of his sort of talks, especially when they talk about meditation, you know, he'll say, you know, sort of, you know, sit down and, you know, then gives various chants to recite. You know, and I remember kind of, okay, well, you know, after I read it the first time, when I go back to read them in later times just to sort of get the techniques down for the meditation, I would always just skip over that, like, okay, well, that's Thai, or that hasn't, you know, I just want to meditate. I don't want this, you know, chanting bit. And it wasn't until years later that I, you know, started, you know, seeing the value of the chanting and actually, you know, doing that on my own. It's like one of the things I like doing is when I do walking meditation, just to, you know, get out to the head of your walking path and just, you know, put my hands in Anjali and, you know, look in front of me on the walking path and just, you know, kind of just do like a dedication or, you know, think, you know, very consciously bring it into mind, you know, like what I'm going to be doing, making the whole thing conscious, and then can just do a, you know, Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa, and just do that three times, and then bow to the walking path just as I'm standing there, just give a bow, and then start my walking meditation period. And then at the end of it, I'll always end that way as well, put my hands in Anjali and then bow to the walking path again, just to, you know, to see it as kind of devotion to wakefulness, devotion to practice. And you know, just doing that, just having that practice of stopping, clearing the mind, bringing the intention really clearly, it helps. You know, it's like obviously during the walking meditation, the mind might start to wander, but you've started from a good place, and it can make it easier to come back to the original intention. So very early on in my meditation practice, I ended up living in an ashram for about a year, and you know, for there, when they talk about, say, devotional practice, it's like a very refined, you know, whole, you know, almost like, you know, there are whole schools of yoga just based on devotion called bhakti yoga, and chanting is, I'd say, almost perfected in those schools, and you're using mostly it's just doing devotional chants towards various gods in their pantheon. But you know, they have it down, the meters down, to get almost trance-like when you do it, and then oftentimes it's done with music. Usually, mostly it's like harmoniums is a very common one, but sometimes you'll get people with, you know, sitars or drums, and it's a very, say, expedient means to kind of get into a blissful state of mind, and you know, it's a, you know, oftentimes they kind of talk about it as just you know, getting you out of, well, one thing is, yeah, it's raising the energy, raising the tension, or, you know, bringing you out of your, they would say, your small self, and sort of bringing you into more of a universal sort of consciousness. And, you know, that was definitely, say, my experience when I was there. And so I saw lots of benefits, and sometimes I hear myself kind of complaining about where the Theravada, kind of like the sparrows of the religious world and our simplicity, and, you know, we don't have the bhakti as part of our practice. And I was asking one of the monks here just at tea time, you know, I was looking at the Pali dictionary, and couldn't find the equivalent in, of the say the word bhakti is a Sanskrit word, and I couldn't find the equivalent, but he pointed it out to me, which is a bhati, B-H-A-T-T-I, and we could tell just by looking at it, because off this dictionary will list not all but many of the places where those particular words will show up in the suttas in the Pali Canon, and everything was sort of post canonical that where it showed up, and it was very short, so it really wasn't doesn't that kind of practice, that kind of devotional using the kind of using emotion to bring you into that kind of state wasn't a practice that the Buddha taught. Though I was pointing out during the right before the chanting to pay attention though to the say the recollection of the pay attention to the words of the chanting, and I think one thing that's just it's fun to do something like that every once in a while, because it's just the evening chanting is something that we do every day, and it can be kind of habitual, just done by rote. But maybe you had the experience of when I said that, that you just paid a little more attention to the chanting, or allowed the meaning of those words to come in during your meditation. So when last year Ajahn or Tankovilo and I went over to Mount Tabor for part of a week to do an icon painting workshop, and there was this I found it beautiful part of their ceremony there during the church service was they would they brought out the Bible and were bringing it out, and people were venerating it, and just before they started reading from it, one of the monks has his duty for the thing was to sort of chant out real loud for everybody. He says, now everybody pay attention. And that was, everybody pay attention. And so it's really funny, I came right in the middle of the service, you get this encouragement to just come back to the present moment and listen to these words that are about to be read. And Tankovilo wouldn't do it, but I was hoping that when I was giving my next Dhamma talk, he would stop in the middle or right in the middle of my Dhamma talk and say, "Everybody pay attention." But he was smart and wouldn't do it. But as you noticed in the chanting, there's the actually I think the word devotion actually comes up like six different times, and so the Buddha, even during his lifetime, he actually did encourage devotional practice, but it wasn't devotion towards say the Buddha himself directly. And one of the places it does come up where the Buddha's talking about reflections in terms of devotion is Ananda is instructing the bhikkhunis, and they're talking about how they're having sort of success using the four foundations of mindfulness, and then Ananda comes back and reports this, and then he's like, that's excellent that they're getting results, or you should be getting results. But he says, but if you don't get results from your meditation practice, if there are hindrances that come up, so like you are putting forth the effort, you are meditating, and either say lust or greed, hatred, or delusion comes into the mind, the Buddha tells Ananda that you should stop that meditation. You should to stop that particular type of meditation, and then bring up either say recollections of the Buddha, recollections of the Dhamma, recollections of the Sangha, and then there's three others, which would be say recollection of your own virtue, and recollections of your own generosity, and then recollection of the devas. And these are all devotional types of practices, and so just bringing into mind, like I was just thinking, like say the Dhamma, the recollection of the Dhamma, it's apparent here and now. Just what you can do is just take those words and maybe even just sort of print them out on a card in front of you, or just have the chant book open, and just take one word and bring it into mind. It's like say the Dhamma, one of the recollections is it's apparent here and now. So like if you're meditating and you're having a really rough time, you know, the mind just doesn't want to settle, or maybe you've been in an uncomfortable conversation with somebody, or someone's asked you to do something you don't feel comfortable doing, and you're having an emotional kind of reaction to that, like, you can just bring up, okay, you know, the Dhamma, you know, the truth is apparent here and now. You know, and just contemplate that, like, you know, what does that mean? It's like, okay, there's, you know, there is this unpleasant feeling, but that's, you know, it's apparent here and now. Or you can think of it in terms of, you know, like, you know, we've conditioned that reaction to be there, and so it's, yeah, you know, it's natural that response would be there, and so, yeah, it may be unpleasant, it's uncomfortable. That's the first noble truth, you know, the dukkha, you know, being a human being, there's going to be dukkha in the world, and so, yeah, I may not like this feeling that's arisen, but this is the truth of the way it is. You know, and then, or you could look at it as, well, you know, there is, you know, Dhamma, there is a truth, there is maybe even peacefulness and contentment in the room. There's no reason why there wouldn't have to be that. So why am I obsessing about this request somebody's made? And so just having that reflection of, yeah, it's apparent here and now. It's like it can just help you to, you know, kind of shift that perspective or that attitude. And then the Buddha says that, you know, you keep working with you know, whichever one of those recollections, of those six that you know, say resonates with your own heart, where you have confidence, where you have desire to put the mind. I'd say it's even like kind of even the easiest way to do it. So that would be the proper use of using the Bic lighter. So which one of those is going to easily, you know, allow you to drop that unskillful attitude or thought, and then, you know, go into, you know, what'll happen is if you contemplate it, and what can happen is that sort of, we have, say, peacefulness will come in, say contentment, and then from that, usually the Buddha will talk about it in terms of like the gradual steps that lead to being concentrated. So there's a, you know, some calm, and then peace, and then joy arises, and then concentration. And so the Buddha says, you know, if you find that you get to that state by doing that particular meditation, then to actually stop that meditation and then go back to the original meditation that you were doing when, you know, the unwholesome or the difficulties came up. You know, which, whatever that could be, like, you know, struggling to try to accomplish something, or say, you know, the mind just wouldn't settle, and so thoughts kept pervading and interrupting. So then to go back and then try, you know, with that newfound confidence and the concentration, to go back to the original meditation. There's many. So part of what I was contemplating talking about this tonight was just the Lumpur's, you know, comment that we don't typically, as Westerners, you know, gravitate towards devotional practices. And several other techniques that I was looking at online just at tea time. I was reading up to see what other kind of traditions said or what other people say. And, you know, one is actually study, sort of like, you know, reading stories of people who've, say, disciples of the Buddha, or, you know, biographies of other people who have practiced, you know, to give us confidence and faith and inspiration in the practice. So, you know, chanting is a really big one, but there can be study. Also, you know, a lot of our daily life is around sort of devotional practices that we, you may not even, you know, recognize. It's just something that we just do habitually, like the chanting we do, but also too the, you know, the beautiful shrines that we have, the Buddha images, and you just as a devotional practice, just you know, learning really to take care of the shrines that we have at our kutis, you know, just you know, putting care into them. You know, we, all of us, you know, various times during the work scenes of, you know, probably had to go by other people's cabins or had to do something inside, and you can see that, you know, people have varying degrees of you know, care and attention to their shrines. But you know, one practice that I think is fun is to, you know, just every day, just to you know, we're always bowing to our shrines. You know, every time we come in and leave our kutis, and you know, before we go to sleep, and even before we meditate or do chanting, just, you know, bow to the shrine. But you know, partly we're bowing to it is because it's something that we hold of value. You know, the say the Buddha, or you know, awakening is as an ideal, as a why we're practicing to overcome dukkha. And so one of the practices I like taking on is like every day actually cleaning your shrine. You know, it's like if it's something that we're really aspiring towards, of awakening to dukkha and the way out of dukkha, then you can just take it as a practice, just to, you know, since you're bowing to the shrine, just to take that as a you know, way of, you know, just, you know, cleaning it every day, is kind of like just recommitting yourself. It's like almost like, you know, taking precepts internally, just having that sense of having a starting the day with a clean shrine. Also, there's a I think it's online, and I think Amravati or Chithurst published this a while back, called Buddhist Rituals and Observances, and you know, I was just kind of reading through that a little bit, and it gives a lot of, yeah, good techniques or some instructions on actually how to develop devotion as a practice. So I guess I'd like to conclude with just encouraging, if, you know, if anybody's interested in developing that kind of, you know, devotion as a meditation practice, that's a very good place to start. Called Buddhist Rituals and Observances. Buddhist Rituals and Observances. So I will end the Dhamma talk there.